The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close just in view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
Alright, party people, it's no secret that most major industries that play a role in society have to serve some purpose for the string pullers or they wouldn't exist. The energy realm carefully keeps us on the resources that turn the most profit, the education system is carefully crafted to keep most people at a level of mediocrity, and the entertainment world keeps us thoroughly distracted from reclaiming our own reality. But even so, most of these slices can be broken down even further, and few get quite as weird and deep as the realm of Hollywood and the music industry. From sacrifice and sorcery to psychedelics and psyops, it's a true cornucopia of conspiracy goodness ripe for plunder. And back in the saddle, here to steer us through the darkness once more, is Mark Devlin, one of my favorite researchers on this topic, author of the massive, all-encompassing Bible on the crossroads of conspiracy and pop culture, his excellent book, Musical Truth. Last time we tackled what we could, but left a lot of great stuff on the table, so let's do the damn thing. Mark, my man, welcome back to the Higher Side.
Greg, your intros are better than most other people's whole shows, so I appreciate that. It's good to be back.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Yeah, it's awesome to have you here. You really know your stuff, which always helps to make a great show. And to kick this off, last time we had talked about how the music industry is used for control of both the artist and the audience, but we didn't get too far into the origins of this manipulation or who's behind it. And I know that's been a big part of your research as of late, so let's dive in there. How far back are you looking now? And was the music industry ever as organic as it's presented? Or was this a military intelligence think tank operation from the ground up?
Well, I'm coming to the devastating realization that this whole thing goes even deeper than I thought when I put the book together. So I was aware that it went pretty deep then. But I've done a whole bunch of research since the book was published earlier this year to make me convinced that the music industry, as well as Hollywood and pretty much every other, you know, institution that has an effect on our daily lives, is absolutely controlled. Most of that control seems to be coming from the military intelligence communities. So organizations such as the CIA and the FBI, and over here in Britain, MI5 and MI6. Also, there's a hell of a lot of influence in all these areas of culture coming from these think tank organizations like the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations in London, the Frankfurt School in Germany, stuff coming out of Cambridge University in England, and then over in the States it would be Stanford University, Yale and Harvard. Certain, you know, elements of those institutions seem to have a stranglehold on all elements of culture. And there's a couple of phrases that I've come across in recent weeks where I've just been delving even deeper down this particular rabbit hole. And one is culture creation, and the other one is lifetime actors. So these were phrases that didn't make it to the book because I've just sort of understood these concepts more recently. Culture creation just refers to the fact that pretty much every social value or attitude that most of us come across in the course of our lives will have been shaped and molded by certain individuals and certain groups. You know, there was a famous quote from Edward Bernays, who's considered the father of PR propaganda. I forget the exact quote, but it was to the effect of our tastes and our attitudes and our values and, you know, things we hold dear are shaped and molded for us by men we've never met and whose names we don't know. And doesn't that turn out to be the truth?
Right.
And then you have lifetime actors, who are people who have a public persona and they appear to be one thing. So that can be a Hollywood actor, it can be a musician, it can be a television presenter, it can be a politician, it can be a supposed philanthropist. But when you get down to their true nature, and crucially, when you often get into their ancestral bloodlines, because genealogy and ancestry plays a big part in, you know, many of these elite key players, then you realize that there's something very different once you scratch the surface. And they spend their entire lives fooling and duping and mugging off the public to believe that they're one thing when they're actually another. So some examples of lifetime actors would be A really good one is Barack Obama, or Barry Sotoro, take your pick, who, you know, I think everyone has come to realize by now the reality of who he is and who he came from is very different to his official biography. There's all sorts of questions remaining still about where exactly he was born and where exactly he was educated and how he came up so quickly in the game. And who is Michelle/Michael? Where did he/she come from? That's another good question. So there's an example of a lifetime actor for you. Many other examples. I mean, Bono and Bob Geldof are a couple of bedfellows that sort of go hand in hand. You know, Bob Geldof for many years successfully masqueraded under this guise of being a philanthropist and this wonderful guy that cared so much about famine in Africa and wanted to do something about it, and he put the Band-Aid and Live Aid projects together. But, you know, with the passage of time and the availability of new information to research, you come to realize that Bob Geldof is absolutely in the pocket of the elites. He's hobnobbing with all the prominent politicians and all the New World Order architects, the Rothschilds and the George Soroses of this world and the Rockefellers and all of that. Same thing with Bono, you know, ostensibly he's supposed to be the front man of this rock group U2, and that's the way he was first presented to us. But you get into the true nature of Bono and you find out he's hanging out with the likes of Bill Gates, and he's down in Africa taking part in the eugenics depopulation agenda that's going on down there, all part of the United Nations Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030. You know, he's absolutely a part of that. So there's some lifetime actors for you. Pretty much every prominent politician, you know, David Cameron, who we've just successfully got rid of over here in England, unfortunately has been replaced by Theresa May. So I think the same time that you guys are going to get Hillary, we've got Theresa May, and there's Angela Merkel over there in Germany. So not looking good on that front, people. But lifetime actors and culture creation. What it all boils down to is nothing is as we thought it was. And the sad reality of the situation is there are no real heroes when it comes to popular figures in culture, whether that's musicians, whether that's Hollywood actors, whether it's some other kind of celebrity. Anyone that's out there in the public eye, anyone that's been elevated to household name status, they're not the heroes that we thought they were. They quite simply would not be in those positions if they weren't placed there by the hidden hand. So on the one hand, it can seem quite a pessimistic, nihilistic sort of viewpoint to conclude that there are no real heroes. But then that just brings you back to the realization that we need to be our own heroes, and we need to stop externalizing power to all these popular culture figures that have been placed there for us, because they're all fake. And, you know, we are the ones that can change things, and we need to rely on ourselves rather than revering these heroes, as we've all been conditioned to do throughout our lives.
Yeah, man. Well said. And you're right, that savior motif is a big trap, and we really do need to stop waiting around for someone else to solve problems and start looking at how we're going to do it ourselves. And I knew we were going to talk about these lifetime actors, and I got a quote from your book. I revisited that part, and I really like this, where you're talking about bloodlines and how they're just as important in the entertainment industry as they are in politics. And it's kind of surprising how this web thread weaves throughout all these different realms. Here's the quote. You say, "It's no accident that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie ended up together, for instance, as they were reported to be related as 21st cousins. It was always part of the plan for them to become a couple, presumably, with Billy Bob Thornton and Jennifer Aniston having been temporary distractions. Pitt, according to research, is related to Barack Obama, as is George W. Bush, and Pitt is also the 9th cousin twice removed of the outlaw Jesse James, and the 12th cousin of both Prince William and the movie director Spike Lee. This would explain why Pitt gets so many Hollywood roles, and why Jolie has been given her extracurricular job as a United Nations ambassador and eugenicist." And it just goes on from there. You talk about Alanis Morissette, Celine Dion, Madonna, Hillary Clinton, Britney Spears. I mean, this is quite a club, isn't it?
It really is. And you just realize that these people are born into it and they're destined to take up these roles. You know, it's not left to chance as to who is going to become the big Hollywood actors and in many cases the prominent musicians that shape and define eras. It's all down to bloodlines and where these people come from. And it's absolutely fascinating when you get into it. I don't know if you've seen, a while back, there were some old pictures floating around from like 100 or 150, 200 years ago of individuals that look very much like current day celebrities.
Yes.
You saw that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of speculation as to whether the people that we see now, the celebrities that we're familiar with, are in some way the reincarnation of the people that appeared in these old photographs, or maybe they're, you know, bloodline descendants of it. But there's some classic ones. There's a picture of an old dude from years ago, an old sepia photograph, looks very much like Nicolas Cage.
Yep.
There's another one, looks very much like John Travolta. And John Travolta's a distinctive looking dude. You know, he's not a regular looking guy. And then you've got Eddie Murphy. There's a black guy from like the 1920s or something. Looks a lot like Jay-Z, and all sorts of other characters in there. And you've got to wonder whether there's something going on here, and whether through the generational bloodlines, these people are just being placed in these prominent positions. Because it seems to me they're all given different roles. You know, some of them are put off into the world of politics. And an interesting one there is Tony Blair, the mass murdering war criminal who quite literally got away with murder in the Chilcot inquiry that we had last week into the Iraq war. You know, Blair stood up there for 2 hours and basically said he didn't regret a thing and he still stands by his decision. And he got away with it and he's walking scot-free, whereas he should be at the very least rotting away in a jail cell for the rest of his days. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I digress. Tony Blair's wife is Sherry Blair. Her maiden name was Sherry Booth. And according to genealogists, she is descended from John Wilkes Booth, who is the guy that is said to have assassinated Abraham Lincoln. Hmm. So isn't that an interesting link?
Yeah.
So, you know, some of these people seem to be sent off into the world of politics. So Sherry Blair was a barrister before she got hooked up with Tony, you know, and they put these people together as well. The same way as they create industry relationships in the music game. So does anyone really believe that Jay-Z and Beyonce fell romantically in love with each other, fell head over heels? They felt they were each other's soul partners and they just had to be together. or was it an industry arranged marriage? You know, come on, who really believes that these couples get together because it's straight romance? They're not. They're placed together conveniently. You know, why were Bill Clinton and Hillary put together as a couple?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a romantic relationship going on there, or were they just placed together as part of some grand plan? So, as I say, many of these individuals coming from these bloodlines have come down through the generations, and they've always played a part in the overall agenda, call it the New World Order agenda or the Illuminati agenda, whatever you want to refer to it as, the elite agenda to control and enslave and subvert humanity. Some of them do it through politics. Then others will be sent into the world of Hollywood to become prominent mainstream actors. So the Brad Pitts of this world and the Tom Cruises and all the others. And then in the world of music, there's so much evidence, which I outline in my book and which many other researchers have as well, that prominent musicians often emanate from these bloodlines as well. Current day ones would appear to be Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus among them. You know, they were born to do it. And there's some interesting sort of ancestral links with those two families when you get into it. And some of the others you detailed there in what you just said. So they're used in different ways. Bono would appear to come from a bloodline that's considered important. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been set to work with all the stuff he's doing now. Bob Geldof, same way. Bob Geldof, it turns out, is half Jewish. And a lot of these individuals are. When you get down to the genealogy, you find there's a lot of Jewishness there. And a lot of them are crypto-Jews, which is individuals of kind of Jewish descent or that refer to themselves as Jewish anyway. But their public persona doesn't reveal this. So they often change their names. They kind of anglicize their names or Americanize their names to hide their Jewish roots. I mean, it's incredible when you get down to it. Hmm. Bob Marley, it turns out, his father, Norvell Sinclair Marley, was himself half Jewish. And he was involved with the British Navy. He was part of the military, as were so many other musicians' fathers. And he worked for a while on a slave plantation in Jamaica. This stuff is absolutely incredible. Who knew that Bob Marley had Jewish links?
Yeah.
Then again, his son Ziggy Marley now lives in Israel and moved out there, and is evidently a supporter of the Zionist regime out there. And he's given Jewish names to all his kids. So, you know, again, it's probably worth pointing out the fact that when you reveal Jewish roots behind key players in the industry, it's not anti-Semitic to be stating all this stuff. You're merely relaying facts, which can be traced back, which can be proven. People are very quick to, the alarm bells ring instantly whenever anyone says the word Jewish, as if, oh, you can't say that. You can't criticize that particular group because of the way we've been programmed. Mm-hmm. But I'm merely pointing out the fact that a hugely out of proportion number of key players in the music industry, that would be, you know, the executives that run the industry on a managerial level, and also many of the key musicians and producers and stuff just happen to have Jewish backgrounds. I think getting to the bottom of that is going to be the key to understanding exactly what's going on. Because as I point out in the book, if it was any other group, if it was Swedish or Portuguese people, questions would be asked. Why are there so many Portuguese people in this industry? But when it comes down to Jewish people, the question tends not to be asked. But it does seem to be key to understanding where a lot of these bloodlines come from and why they place their descendants in these prominent roles in culture.
Yeah, you can't deny it's there. And you mentioned Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears. Of course, Disney had a hand in their creation and a lot of these child stars. It almost seems like Justin Timberlake might be the only half-normal guy who's navigated the Disney path through Hollywood. I mean, they all come out kind of messed up when they hit that 25, 30-year-old range.
Yeah, really. And a lot of it comes out of Disney, which is a deeply satanic corporation when you get down to it, very different from its public persona. This is the trick they always use. You know, they give you a nice all-American friendly, family-friendly, squeaky clean image, but you get beneath the surface and, you know, if you bother to do the research, you can come to discover that there's some very nefarious, malevolent stuff going on beneath the surface. It's what they did with a lot of these artists that came out of Disney. Britney Spears, when she first emerged, was this kind of squeaky clean pop star. Same thing with Miley Cyrus when she was Hannah Montana. Same thing with Christina Aguilera. All of them came out of the Disney Mickey Mouse Club. And then there comes a point in their career, very early on in the case of Britney Spears, where they just switch them up. And they become basically sluts, you know, mm-hmm. porn stars in the case of Miley Cyrus. By that point, they've gained the fan base. They've got all these young girls that think they're great. And the parents have been disarmed. They think it's all harmless and they don't mind their little girls being into all this stuff because it comes out of Disney and what could be wrong with that. But then, you know, by the time they switch them up, it's too late. These girls are just caught up in all the mind control and all the symbolism that's employed by these artists. So that's the way they do it with Disney. Miley Cyrus, of course, is connected to Billy Ray Cyrus, her father, country music artist. And when you get down to the country music scene, that would appear to be a hotbed of MKUltra, monarch programming, trauma-based mind control activity. I did an interview with Fritz Springmeier a while back, probably about 4 years ago now, and people might be aware he is an author and a researcher and a reprogrammer of former mind control slaves. And he wrote the book The Illuminati Guide on How to Create a Total Undetectable Mind-Controlled Slave. That's a title that just rolls off the tongue, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was his masterwork in showing how these mind control methods work. And he spent a lot of time talking about the country music scene and how, you know, mind control is absolutely rife within that particular genre. And he told me about he watched this stage show once involving Dolly Parton. And when you get into beta sex kitten programming, sex slave programming, and you realize that a lot of these sex slaves take on an image which is very evocative of Marilyn Monroe, you know, the bleach blonde hair. There seems to be a lot of characteristics that these sex slaves that are put to use within elite circles. So they're given to presidents and business leaders and world leaders and stuff as basically sex slaves. And Marilyn Monroe is the sort of ultimate archetype. Well, when you think of Dolly Parton and the way she's looked over the years, she very much fits into that overall image. And Springmeier was saying there was this one particular stage show where she walked out and this guy that was supposed to be her manager came out on stage and she put her hand on his in a subversive kind of way and referred to him as daddy. And Fritz was saying, you know, this is classic mind control victim handler stuff going on. And they're putting it right out there in plain sight for everyone to see. And there's much more of that in the country music game, he says. So, you know, it goes very deep and all these different genres overlap. And the music industry has a lot of overlap with Hollywood, as I said, and with all other areas of culture and, you know, popular everyday stuff that we're all into.
Yeah. And you mentioned the satanic switch from squeaky clean image to just down and dirty, all out crazy. And you mentioned in the book that this kind of happened with the Beatles, too. They started out making innocent pop songs, but the switch was in 1966. Then they went psychedelic. And I guess I'd ask you, what was the catalyst? Do you think this was part of the plan for the Beatles from the ground up?
I think it was. I've listened to other researchers who feel that the Beatles were corrupted. You know, they started out with the best of intentions, and they started out as this organic group that evolved naturally. And the powers that be observed their gaining popularity and thought, we can't allow this group to continue under their own steam. We've got to co-opt them and get them on board with the agenda. I don't see it that way. The way I see it is the Beatles from the very start were created with the view to them being used further down the line for culture creation and as part of the plan that they had in place for the latter part of the 1960s. So it was a classic tactic that was used. I mean, many researchers, most notably John Coleman, who was a former MI6 operative in Britain, is of the view that the Beatles were a product of the Tavistock Institute. And it wouldn't surprise me if that turned out to be the case. The same thing is said of the Rolling Stones. And so I think the idea was to get them very popular very quickly. And they would never have left it to chance that four lads from Liverpool that worked really hard and wrote some great songs and gained a fan base for themselves would have become the biggest group of the 1960s and an absolute cultural phenomenon on both sides of the Atlantic and everywhere else around the world. That's not the sort of thing that these controllers leave to chance. They want to be in control of everything. So when it comes to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, the two biggest groups of the 1960s, they would absolutely have been in charge of that whole transition and that whole process. So with the Beatles, they kind of disarmed their fans in the same way as the likes of Britney Spears that I mentioned and Miley Cyrus. And it was the same thing with Beyonce when she first started out with Destiny's Child. It was nice, innocent, pleasant R&B songs that everyone could like. And it was only later down the line that all the dark satanic stuff started creeping in. Same thing with Rihanna. You know, they just roll out the same templates and blueprints over and over. When a plan works for them, they just use it generation after generation. So with the Beatles, they started out with all these nice, pleasant, fluffy sort of pop songs, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Love Me Do, From Me to You, She Loves You, Twist and Shout, all this stuff. And by the time 1966 rolled around, by which point the world was a very different place to how it was in 1960 at the start of that decade. The Vietnam War was in full flow. JFK had been assassinated. Malcolm X had been assassinated. You had the beginnings of the counterculture hippie scene coming out of California. You had the arrival of LSD, also magic mushrooms, and the music was starting to get very psychedelic and very experimental and very tripped out. And it's my view that none of that happened by accident. It was all part of a coordinated plan that absolutely went off according to the timescale, with 1966 being a very key year. And that was the point where the Beatles music changed. And by the time the Sgt. Pepper album came out with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and then you had songs like Helter Skelter and Revolution Number 9 and Within You, Without You, I Am the Walrus, all this strange out there music. The fan base that had been brought along for the first 3 or 4 years was kind of being switched up to this new style of music. But most of them wouldn't really have questioned too much what was going on, because this was the Beatles. They were loved, they were trusted, and if that's the music they were now putting out, the fans were content to go with it, not realizing that they were the victims of social engineering. In the 1960s, who even understood what social engineering was, apart from those actually doing it? We have a much better grasp on how all that stuff works now, because we have the internet available to us to do the research. But back then, nobody would have been aware of the mind control that was being put on them. And what they did with the Beatles in switching up their music, so that by the time they disbanded in 1969, the job had been done, you know.
Yeah.
An entire generation had been steered off down a certain path. They'd had certain social attitudes fomented in their minds for them. And it was a job well done as far as the Hidden Hand was concerned. They played their part in that. And it's absolutely my view that they were controlled and manipulated and directed from day one. People are horrified to hear that, particularly original generation Beatles fans. But as with so much information that I'm putting out today and which I put out in the book, it just comes down to the fact that it is what it is and truth is truth. And sometimes it's very hard to deal with. Sometimes it's inconvenient. Sometimes it's unsettling. Sometimes you'd so wish it was another way. But it either is or it isn't. And if it's the truth, it's the truth. So do you want to know it or don't you?
Yeah, man, I'm right there with you. This is an area where I do sometimes get a bit uncomfortable because I've had some of the most profound experiences on psychedelics. They've played key roles in every major turning point in my life. But I can, of course, see the flip side. And I've known plenty of burnouts that have lost a lot to that lifestyle. But, you know, as Gordon White put it to me, that time period very much looks like field testing of MKUltra's forced initiation program. It's not to say that some value can't come from these things if done carefully and responsibly, but it does seem like there was some real irresponsible testing going on, just field testing on America's youth back in that day.
Yeah, really. And a lot of the cultural heroes that emerged in the 1960s that were seen to be a part of the hallucinogenic psychedelic scene would also turn out to be controlled and to be assets of the state. So we're getting into the realms of the stuff that Jan Irvin talks about, your old friend from Gnostic Media. I know you had an interesting time with him in your interview, but I had a good chat with Jan about a month ago for one of my own podcasts, and he was talking to me about characters like Dr. Timothy Leary, who was always seen as the acid guru and this cool Harvard professor that kind of discovered LSD and encouraged the youthful generation of the 1960s to go on these amazing journeys of self-discovery and explore their consciousness with this amazing drug, you know. And then you had characters like Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters, and then Terence McKenna, who has been revealed to have been a CIA asset. I know that came up in your chat with Jan. And R. Gordon Wasson, of course, who was the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms, at least in terms of popularizing them in the US. All these characters, it turns out, have links to military intelligence, specifically the CIA. So it would seem even these cultural icons outside of the music game, but nevertheless connected to it, their links can all be traced back to the same sources. So it's military intelligence and secret service and various elements of the government each and every time. But then tied into that, you also have the world of the dark occult, because it seems Satanism, Luciferianism, and other dark occult mystery school teachings go absolutely hand in hand with the world of military intelligence. And so, you know, military intelligence is not just all about secrets in terms of surveillance and matters of national security. It's also about secrets in terms of occulted information about, you know, the mysteries of the universe, the nature of reality, how to manipulate energy, how the human psyche works, how to do mind control on large numbers of people. This is all secret occulted information that appears to be tied into the world of the CIA and MI6 and MI5 and all the rest of it. So the whole thing goes very deep indeed. And I'm making the point now in all the public talks that I'm doing connected to my book that there are common elements that you find time and time again when you get into the backstory of the music industry and the entertainment industry generally. And they include satanic ritual abuse, generational pedophilia, the influence of dark occult mystery school groups and networks, specifically those helmed by Aleister Crowley, such as the OTO, the Order of the Golden Dawn, the AA, and many others. Then you get a large number of suicides, in inverted commas, and a large number of accidental overdoses. And there's all sorts of other stuff tied into it as well. And the point I'm making in all my public talks as well is people might like to ask themselves what any of this stuff should have to do with the music industry, if it's all about fun and having a laugh and forgetting all the stresses and strains of the working week and just enjoying yourself with a bit of music at the weekend. There should be no connections between any of this stuff at all, and yet it's everywhere.
Well said, man. And, you know, I did hear that recent interview you had with Jan. I actually really liked it. You know, obviously me and him, we had an argument. It's really not that big a deal. People argue, but He does have some good information, and he mentioned, just like in the same vein, that the Tavistock Institute was founded by Eric Trist, and his son, Alan Trist,
right,
was the Grateful Dead's tour manager. I mean, that's pretty damning right there. How do you rectify that if you want to have, you know, quote unquote, faith in the Grateful Dead? And I mean, if the system really wanted to shut down drug culture, they could have done it very easily. They know that the groups that are touring that these drugs are following, if it was really about getting the drugs off the street, it could have easily been done. So, yeah, I mean, definitely these roots are there. And just as you've been saying, the military intelligence control over the music industry goes much deeper than previously thought.
Well, it does. I mean, I can't remember with the last chat how much we got into the work of Dave McGowan and everything that he uncovered about the Laurel Canyon scene, and specifically Jim Morrison's dad being Admiral Morrison,
mm-hmm,
who was in charge of a fleet of ships involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident that basically started the Vietnam War. I can't remember if we mentioned that one.
We did.
Okay, people might like to take a look at the work of Dave McGowan, and specifically his book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, because he details a whole bunch of links going back to the military and the secret services and the world of intelligence from all these prominent musicians that emerged out of the hippie counterculture scene mid to late 1960s. And it goes deeper than that. You know, on the British side of things, you look at Cliff Richard, very interesting character. Cliff Richard's been in the news recently over here in the UK. There were a couple of police investigations launched involving him, and it was to do with a religious rally, a Christian rally event, which took place in 1985 in South Yorkshire. And it involved the very well-known Christian, it says here, evangelist Billy Graham. And Cliff Richard was involved in these events as well. And there were allegations that minors, these young lads, were sexually molested at these events. And Cliff Richard's name came up in the investigations. So over the course of 2 years, there were a bunch of police cases open looking into all of this. And just a couple of weeks ago, we got the news that the cases had been dropped due to insufficient evidence being available to bring any kind of prosecution. So Cliff Richards walked away from that one, but it has kind of sullied his name and his image in the minds of many who previously had always thought of him as this squeaky clean, there we go again, Christian singer. And he's been on the scene since day one. He emerged in 1958, first of all, with the song Move It. And he kind of fashioned himself as a sort of British Elvis. So it was rock and roll stuff in the early years before he reinvented himself as a Christian singer and started putting out all this awful, slushy, saccharine stuff at Christmas, like mistletoe and wine and Saviour's Day and stuff like that. But you get into some of the background of Cliff Richard, and it turns out that in the early days, he was closely associated with the Cray twins, who were these notorious mobsters, gangsters, coming out of the East End of London. Both got jailed eventually for murder. So what the hell is Cliff Richard doing hobnobbing with these guys? And then you find out that Cliff Richard's father worked for Thorn EMI. And most people, when they think of Thorn EMI, would think of a record company, an electronics company. But it turns out that Thorn EMI had a division of its business that was involved in, wait for it, military research, defense weapons systems and such. And actually, a lot of the record companies in those early days did, such as Decca, Parlophone, RCA, Capitol Records. They all had divisions that were involved in, you know, weapons and defense and other work for the military. So who knew that? And immediately, if you're paying attention with all this stuff, your eyebrows start to raise when you realize that yet again, we have another prominent household name musician whose dad just happened to work in, you know, military intelligence circles. It sounds like Laurel Canyon all over again. And another piece of information that McGowan put out involved the scene that pretty much took over from the Laurel Canyon folk rock scene as it started to die out in the 1970s, which was the emergence of what came to be known as New Wave or post-punk. And he pointed out that there was one particular family that was very involved in shaping the way that particular genre went. They signed a lot of the acts to major record labels. They booked a lot of the live shows, and they basically formulated the careers of many of those key players. And that is the Copeland family. And the patriarch of that family was one Miles Copeland, who was a big-time career CIA guy involved in many foreign coups on behalf of the CIA. worked all the way around the world for several decades, and he had three sons, Miles Copeland Jr., Ian Copeland, and Stuart Copeland. Stuart Copeland, people might recall, was the founding member of the group The Police, a group which also included Sting, as in, you know, a sting operation. And then you had Miles Copeland Jr., who formed a company called the International Record Syndicate, or IRS for short. And then his brother Ian had a company, I forget the full name of it, but the initials break down as FBI. So you have a CIA guy with three sons who between them form the IRS, the FBI, and the police. I think they're trying to tell us something there.
Yeah.
Also, let me just add Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. His father was involved in aeronautical engineering on behalf of the government and the defense departments as well. So once again, founding member of another highly successful, highly prominent, iconic group with another connection back into military intelligence. It seems nobody is who we thought they were.
Right. Yeah, the examples just stack up, man. And I wanted to talk to you about some recent stuff that's happened since we last talked. And last time, we did spend a good amount of time on the revelation of the method and natural law and karma, explaining why they tell us what they're doing.
Sure.
And just recently, well, you did mention generational pedophilia, which is what made me think of this. Because just recently, Jay-Z released this song, Spiritual, with lyrics that go, "Pray your father's father wasn't touching his daughter, creating transgenerational trauma that shoulda hauntcha." I mean, he's basically alluding to that same thing right there.
Exactly. What is that lyric doing in a hip-hop track? What possible reason is it there for, if not to give us some kind of indication of what is really going on in line with revelation of the method, yeah, as we discussed last time? I mean, that lyric just leapt out at me when I heard the song last week. And there's a lot to talk about in terms of what Jay-Z is being used for currently and what Beyonce seems to be getting used for as well. So I don't know whether you want to go into that now or whether you want to cover that later.
Yeah, we can go into it now because obviously the manipulation of hip hop and black culture is a huge part of the agenda in kind of the more recent decades after the 60s thing. And Jay-Z, of course, is near the top of that with, you know, companies like Rockefeller Records. I mean, it's pretty blatant in Jay-Z's case, but tell us what you're seeing from him these days.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to make the point that in my book, I outline the very strong suggestion that there are metaphysical and spiritual components to the art form of hip hop. And hip hop goes much deeper than most people think. I've got this guy called Black Dot, who's an amazing researcher. He does a lot of work with Professor Griff, actually, at a Public Enemy. And I quote him in the book from an interview that I did with him last year. And he's talking about how he came to realize that the five central elements of hip-hop culture, so that would be MCing, DJing, breaking, you know, b-boy breakdancing, graffiti, and the sort of overall spiritual element of it, the knowledge of self, the modern reinterpretations or reawakenings of ancient African traditions coming out of past civilizations down in Africa. So he's making the point that the hip hop MC, the rapper, is the modern interpretation of the storyteller, you know, the sage, the guru that would bring wisdom through poetry and spoken word and such. And then the drummer in these ancient civilizations is represented in modern hip hop by the DJ providing the rhythm for the tracks, you know, scratching out rhythms and keeping the beat going. That's the, you know, the reworking of that. Then the b-boy breakdancers are just the modern interpretation of spiritual dancers, shamanic kind of dancers coming out of those cultures. And then you've got the graffiti, which is a modern interpretation of ancient hieroglyphics, expressing oneself through sacred symbols, which is very, very interesting stuff when you think about it. And his view is that in the 1970s, when this culture first started to emerge out of the streets of the Bronx in New York, those pioneers of hip hop were tapping into some kind of spiritual energy that was coming through them, and they were channeling it, and they were recreating this culture and this civilization for a new generation in a new part of the world. It's a very compelling argument, and I can definitely see how that could play out as someone that's been into hip hop for many years. So that's Black Dot's view. and Professor Griff goes along with this, that hip-hop, when it first started out, had some very spiritual, religious, even, components to it. And the powers that be, those that control things, would have got wind of this, and it would have been noticed. So what if the drive to completely degrade and subvert and water down and bastardize hip-hop the way we've seen it happen over the course of the past 25 years or so at the hands of the corporations is an attempt to snuff out these benevolent spiritual components in the art form? So what if when the gangster rap genre was cultivated and when the music started off going down the route of the lyrics talking about nothing other than gang banging and petty crime and selling drugs, and then all the materialistic stuff came in talking about champagne and gold chains and bullshit brands, you know, clothing brands and trainer brands and all the rest of it. What if all that is a deliberate attempt to just destroy the beautiful art form of hip hop as it was? In my view, that's exactly what went on. And I can see how that agenda unfolded from pretty much the early 90s going forward. And every year it's just got more and more degraded to the point that what now passes as so-called hip-hop bears no relation to what went before whatsoever. I mean, the likes of Lil Wayne and Drake and Big Sean and Future and these, even Kanye West, the way he is now, these flag bearers for the so-called genre of hip-hop are just complete clowns, and their music is just straight spirit-crushing, soul-destroying garbage. And none of that would be by chance. That would have all been made to happen. So the prominent figure we've had for the past 20 years plus riding the helm of all of this has been Jay-Z. And he's a very different artist now to how he was when he first came out. I was full of admiration for Jay-Z when he first broke through. So his first album was Reasonable Doubt in 1996, 20 years ago. And that was when we first heard about the Rockefeller record label. Interesting choice of name. But, you know, he was clearly a phenomenally gifted MC. And a lot of real hip-hop heads were very impressed when he first came on the game. And slowly, using a, you know, slow drip effect, totalitarian tiptoe type thing, Jay-Z's music started to change as the years progressed. And you could start to see, again, if you were paying attention, that there was an agenda unfolding. And in recent years, it's been clear to see that Jay-Z's videos are absolutely steeped with Masonic imagery, dark satanic stuff, Kabbalistic stuff, all kinds of elements that you would not expect to see in a hip-hop video if it's all about entertainment or even uplifting and inspiring people, which was the original ethos of hip-hop, and things are very far from that now. And then he hooked up with Beyonce, of course, and all her stuff is steeped with the same kind of imagery, glorifying police state imagery, glorifying transhumanist symbolism, as well as all the dark occult stuff at the stage shows and things like that. And the music itself, in terms of the sound frequencies that's now going into it and the production methods, it's all designed to take an entire generation of young people that listen to this stuff and just completely crush their spirituality and put certain belief systems and values and perceptions into their minds, all done on a subconscious subliminal level. It's very clear to see how that genre has been absolutely co-opted. And what we've seen recently over the past few years is a whole bunch of hip hop videos that have featured militarized police dressed all in black, the way we now see these police thugs that are involved in all these incidents that play out on the evening news, you know. Mm-hmm. You've seen troops of these militarized police joining in dance routines and, you know, just getting involved in the track. And up until recently, it's all presented the view that isn't this fun, isn't this great, you know, the police are cool, aren't their uniforms great, you know, they're getting down with the party and all this sort of thing. But recently, it started to become a lot darker. And you've started to see violent scenes playing out in music videos, and you've started to see confrontations and standoffs between these militarized police and the other people in the video. And so, bringing it right forward to events of the last week or so, with this terrorist incident in Dallas, where this guy Micah Johnson is said to have gunned down five white cops in Dallas, it's interesting how many elements of this type of scenario have cropped up in music videos very recently. So you had one from Beyoncé called Formation, where it depicts a bunch of riot cops surrendering and sort of putting their hands up to the other people involved in the video. Jay-Z brought out this track Spiritual that you just mentioned with that very interesting lyric. And there's all kinds of police-related imagery in that video as well. And there's also this god-awful track by DJ Khaled featuring Jay-Z and featuring this absolute joker called Future, who's very much at the forefront of the transhumanist agenda in terms of normalizing electronic ways of doing things and the merging of humanity and technology, because his trademark is you never hear him doing anything other than singing, so-called, through auto-tune. This bloody awful software program that makes everyone sound like a robot that has become very fashionable in the world of hip-hop, so-called, over the past few years. I mean, if people thought T-Pain and Akon were bad, listen to Future. I always say he sounds like Stephen Hawking's voice box with the batteries running out. Absolutely ridiculous. So he's all over this track. And then if you look at that video, you've got riot cops in there, and you've got standoffs between groups of black people and these white cops. And a lot of researchers are making the connection between all this stuff that we've seen in recent videos and this race baiting stuff that seems to be going on in the news and is unfolding by the day, in terms of, first of all, white cops shooting a bunch of black people and inciting the wrath of black communities and, you know, getting away with murder, as they generally tend to. And then more recently, we've had this incident that appears to be a reversal of it, which is this black terrorist gunning down these white cops in Dallas at a Black Lives Matter march protest event. So to me, it seems to be yet another exercise in social engineering from our old friends, the controllers, you know, and they seem to have been preparing people for what they knew was going to come by way of these music videos using certain key artists, in this case Beyonce, Jay-Z, DJ Khaled, Future, and a few others. We've also seen this in Will.i.am videos as well, and Black Eyed Peas videos over the years. There's been a lot of symbolism in there involving cops and a militarized police state and depictions of martial law as well. And when you understand how predictive programming works, when you understand how getting to people through the subconscious and planting certain images and symbols in their mind works, you can see that for the past few years, they've been preparing the general public on a subconscious level for something that they've known to be coming. And it seems to be the beginnings of that starting to play out now with all this race baiting stuff. The plan seems to be to pit black communities against white communities and sow division and fear and confusion and conflict. Classic divide and conquer, you know, textbook example of it. A lot of people can see it, but a lot of people still can't. So they need it spelled out to them in terms of how all this works, because they've done it a million times before. And as I say, it's all the same old tactics being used this time. And it seems that what passes for hip hop is being used for that agenda now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, especially with Beyonce, you see her taking this Black Panther militant type of persona. And it's not that these killings by police aren't brutal and they shouldn't get people emotionally worked up. But what's going on with her, it's not natural. She seems like an instigator, you know? I don't see her ever getting off the red carpet and doing anything of substance to actually solve these problems.
She would have been instructed to make these comments, you know? Right. I've looked at a few chat forums recently and YouTube comments and stuff, and people are saying, oh, you know, Beyonce's becoming an activist and she's speaking her mind. No, she's not. She's working to a script and she's doing what she's told to do. Same way these puppets always do. Look at Russell Brand the other year. People were saying, oh, Russell Brand, you know, he's become conscious, he's woken up, he's fighting against the New World Order, he's going up against these elites. Absolutely not. I mean, what was Russell Brand? An actor. What do actors do? Read scripts and play roles. That's all he was doing. This self-styled sort of revolutionary, you know, voice of the people. What the hell is he saying now? You know, we had the Brexit EU vote in the UK last month. I didn't hear Russell Brand getting up on a podium and ranting and raving about that. Why? Because his work is done. You know, he was used last year and the year before to foment certain attitudes in people's minds and create certain public perceptions. And it's been done. So now he's moved on and he's not required anymore. And that's what they do with these individuals. It's been decided that Beyoncé can play a role in what's now going on in shaping these social attitudes, because so many people look up to these celebrities and hang on their every word. So she can be very influential in that regard. But next year it will be somebody else and she will be moved on to a different agenda. These celebrities are not speaking their minds because they're not allowed to. Many of them don't even have minds of their own. There's a classic video that people could check out of Beyoncé together with Jay-Z, and it's at some sporting event. I forget which one. But Beyoncé is rocking from side to side and she's mumbling incoherently to herself. And if you look at her eyes, there's just nothing there. She appears to be in a trance. And it's a classic hint at, you know, dissociative mind control. She's slipped into a trance. And Jay-Z is sat next to her and he just doesn't give a shit, you know. he just couldn't care less. His wife is behaving very strangely next to him, but he's acting like he's seen it all before and it's no big deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, what is going on there? Because she just doesn't appear to be all there. And that is the case with so many of these artists. They're programmed and they're given these scripts and given these roles. Again, we're back to lifetime actors to fulfill. So, like I say, Beyoncé's being used for this one. Also Jay-Z. But next time it'll be somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And to elaborate a little more on the transhumanism tie-in, you mentioned Auto-Tune, the robotic voice, of course, and Will.i.am, his very name, reads like a web address.
Yeah.
But are there other examples of music's role in normalizing the transhumanist agenda that you've noticed?
Well, I think most of it for me just comes from the proliferation of Auto-Tune, because what else could account for it being everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes it. Every DJ, every producer, every sound engineer, every listener to music that you speak to has got nothing but scathing, scornful words about autotune. Everyone hates it. So why the hell is it so popular? I think it's long been my view that the idea is to normalize electronic ways of doing things. And by having a human voice that sounds like a robot, it's just one small step further in getting people used to the idea of cyborgs and androids everywhere. And, you know, machines dictating your every daily move. So we have things like driverless cars now and driverless trucks on the road. We've got the city of Glasgow in Scotland has become the first smart city in the UK, smart so-called. Smartest thing about anything smart with smart in the front of it is giving it the widest berth possible, which would include smartphones, because they're not there to make your lives easier. They're there for surveillance purposes and they're there to, you know, bathe you in radiation and electromagnetic pollution and stuff. So in Glasgow now, you've got all these buildings and all these devices and all these different aspects of the city all kind of communicating with each other wirelessly by way of an endless array of Wi-Fi links, very similar to what smart meters do in your home. And that can't be a good idea for human health when you understand that we're made up of energy, everything is. And, you know, we're existing in this morphogenic field, which consists of a bunch of frequencies and vibrations. And when you've got all these Wi-Fi signals and mobile phone signals and stuff all swimming about and creating this kind of soup that we're existing in and that's going into our brains and our bodies and our human energy fields, then you can see very quickly that it's not going to be great for human health. The results aren't going to be fantastic. But in Glasgow, you know, you've got this stuff going everywhere. And that's obviously the blueprint for what they want to roll out elsewhere, because they often use Scotland as a testing ground for what they want to do elsewhere in the UK. So the plan will be for there to be further smart cities. We've got a smart motorway now, so-called, a section of the M6 near Birmingham, where, you know, everything communicates with each other and gives you data feedback and stuff. And, of course, a lot of it is to do with surveillance as well, spying and surveillance. In Glasgow, apparently you've got lampposts that can speak to you. So, you know, if somebody's sat in a control room and they're watching a street and some riot is about to erupt, they can bark some order out through a lamppost, you know, which is a nightmare scenario. It sounds like something out of George Orwell's 1984, but it's all starting to become true. And it all ties in with the transhumanist agenda. They want everything controlled by computers, including humanity. So that's where microchips come in. That's where brain implants come in. Eventually, they've made no secret of the fact, it's in their own documents, that they want a population that is microchipped and is linked up to a massive computer grid so that every aspect of your life can be controlled remotely, from financial transactions to medication even that's released into your bloodstream by way of the microchips. You know, this stuff might sound fantastic to people, but the evidence is there that it's already in place. There's some companies now, there's one in Sweden that I cite in the book, where a condition of employment there is that you take a microchip under your wrist so that you can do things like open doors and operate the photocopier and things like that. And if you don't have one, you can't do all these things. Huh. And they're microchipping the military as well, because the military are always used as guinea pigs for what they want to roll out elsewhere. So it's all part of the transhumanist agenda. And in music, as I touched on earlier, they normalize things that they want to introduce, and they create a kind of familiarity in the public with what they know is coming. And they do it on this subliminal level. So what better way to sow all this symbolism into the unwitting minds of the general public, and particularly young people, because people of a certain age, my generation and above, are likely to be very suspicious and very skeptical of any claims that a technological society is the way to go, because we remember the way things were done previously. And, you know, we just tend to be a bit more skeptical of these new ways of doing things. But young people that have only ever known this stuff think it's great, particularly when you reflect on the fact that there are people of 18, 20 years of age today that are getting into music that have never seen or played a vinyl record. They've got no idea what a cassette is. You know, all they've ever known is MP3s and listening to music off a computer or off their phone. So, you know, within a generation's time, all these analog ways of doing things will be gone. And people will only ever have known digital ways of listening to music and running their lives. And these are the sort of people that are probably going to think that a transhumanist society sounds great because of the way it's presented to them. It's presented as, isn't technology wonderful? You know, it's here to help you, to make your life better, make your life easier. Isn't it a pain in the arse having a pocket full of cash? Well, imagine if you could just, you know, have your chip scanned when you want to buy something and it comes up on a screen and there you go, you know, no more wallets to carry around. This is the way it's presented to young people, and they seem to be snapping it up. Another very important message to get through to the younger generation is transhumanism is not your friend. It's not being introduced to help you. It's being introduced to enslave you. Read Brave New World. Read 1984. Look at some of these movies that have warned us about this by way of, you know, the predictive programming and stuff. It's a very nefarious agenda, and music has been used to get people on board with it. So wake up and understand what is being done on all these different levels.
Boom. Yeah, man, that was great. And you're making me feel old, but you're right. Things are changing.
Right.
So we tackled the 60s music culture, as well as what we saw in the 90s from hip hop and the rise of the robotic artists in the last decade. Are there any other major gameplay changes you see happening in music now, or perhaps going forward, that have your attention?
I'm paying close attention, as I mentioned earlier, to this electronic dance music scene, because, like I said, I'm seeing all the same kind of symbols and calling cards cropping up among the key players there that I've already seen in hip-hop and R&B. And I think that's going to be an interesting one to watch in the months and years ahead in terms of how it all plays out. And as I said, that's a worldwide phenomenon. I was going to say global, but I've trained myself not to use the word global anymore since all this flat earth stuff came up.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean...
Say it ain't so.
Yeah, I'm kind of veering towards it, you know, but I have trained myself not to use the word global. So I do kind of hesitate sometimes and substitute it for the word worldwide. But anyway, yeah, so I'm going to be doing a volume 2 of the book, and basically the rest of this year is going to be spent continuing to promote Musical Truth Volume 1. I'm doing a whole bunch of talks. Next year, I intend to knuckle down to the very elaborate job of putting together Volume 2. And there's a bunch of things I want to look at there. So I do want to understand the electronic dance world better. I do want to really get into this question of whether the Second Summer of Love, the acid house phenomenon, was a reworking of what they rolled out in the 60s with the original Summer of Love. I want to look into the science of sound, sound production, and cymatics, understand a bit more about how what's going on at an energetic level in a particular sound recording can have an effect on the human body, the human mind, brainwave states, and the human energy field. That's getting into the frequency question, you know, 440 versus 432 hertz, which is a very popular subject area that really seems to be sparking interest in a lot of people. I want to look at heavy metal and heavy rock because that's an area that I've never dug that music as a consumer, so I've never listened to it. So it's going to be me just looking at it strictly from a research point of view. But when it comes to the suggestion of Satanism and the devil horns being flashed up everywhere and subliminal messages in recordings, the heavy rock genre is one that you hear about all the time, heavy metal. So I need to do some more research into that. That's going to be going into volume two. So there's all these other things that I need to look at next time around. And it's quite exciting because I realize there's still a lot more to know. And there's so much that I've come to know since finishing volume one. This really is a subject that just goes on and on and on. And I could quite easily do an all-day seminar of 10 to 12 hours and only just begin to unpack all the information. So most of my talks at the moment are like 2 hours. And so I have to be picky and I have to say, okay, I'm going to talk about MKUltra, trauma-based mind control, and transhumanism, because that's all I can get into 2 hours. I have to leave all the CIA military intelligence links to another day, because to do it justice, it would just go on and on and on. And no, in reality, you could probably have a whole series of books. You could probably do like 20 volumes of this stuff. And then you come to realize that what happens in the music industry and the entertainment industry generally is only one spoke in the wheel of what's really going on in the world. So, you know, you have false flag terror events, understanding the likes of 9/11 better, and you have banking scams, and you have the political scene, and you have Freemasonry, and you have Bohemian Grove and stuff that goes on there, and all these other subject areas, chemtrails, fracking, Monsanto, GM foods, and each of these subject areas in their own right could take up hours and hours and hours. And the music industry stuff is just one element of everything else that's going on. It's just so massive and overwhelming. And you can only really sum it up by saying the world is nothing like we thought it was. And that's an understatement.
Yeah, right on. Man, Mark, you are one of my favorite guys on these subjects today, a real wealth of info. And there's still a lot of stuff in just the first musical truth book that we've had to leave on the table in these two exactly. conversations.
Exactly.
I recommend the book to anyone who wants the full scope of musical conspiracies to date. Would you like to remind the people where they can get it and other things you got going on, like the podcast, before we close the books?
Sure. Well, people can get the book via Amazon. So there's a hardback, there's a paperback, and there's a Kindle version. So whichever one floats your boat, you can get them all at Amazon if you just do a search for Mark Devlin, Musical Truth. It's also available from Barnes & Noble. If anyone wants to get a copy from me personally, I'm signing copies and posting them out myself. If you want to drop me an email to mark@markdevlin.co.uk and you can pay by PayPal, then we can have a little, you know, private arrangement go in there. So just drop me an email. I'm doing a bunch of talks. The talks I've got coming up are all in the UK. So details of those are listed at musicaltruthbook.com. One thing I did want to mention is that I want to come back to the States next year. I come out every year for the Free Your Mind conference near Philadelphia, and I'm going to be there next year, April. That conference runs 7th to 9th of April. Don't think I'm going to be speaking next year. I did the last two. I think I'm just going to come as a punter and take in the speakers, and I'll have a merchandise table with my books. But during that trip, I want to build in an extra quick visit to Los Angeles, because my interest has been sparked so much by everything that I've read in Dave McGowan's book about Laurel Canyon and all the strange, weird stuff that went on there, that I just need to see that place with my own eyes. So,
yeah, man.
I intend to get my ass out to LA, and I would love to get a little tour of all these key spots in Laurel Canyon, Lookout Mountain and the Log Cabin and where all these musicians hung out, and maybe some of the clubs on Sunset Strip. So the ideal thing would be if somebody who has a knowledge of all this stuff would be happy to give me a quick tour of all these places. So if anyone listening has any kind of connections in that regard, then please do reach out to me again via email, mark@markdevlin.co.uk, because I'm feeling magnetically drawn to Laurel Canyon to want to check that place out. And that's something I want to do during my trip in April next year. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah.
The other thing to mention is that I've got a conscious music podcast. So obviously in these interviews, I spend a lot of time talking about all this dark, demonic stuff that's going into music recordings and all these artists. But, you know, there's a flip side to that. And there's an antithesis to all that negative stuff, which is all this wonderfully uplifting, conscious, meaningful music that's still being made. It is still out there. There are musicians that are in control of their own careers. They have minds of their own to think with, and they have no corporate shackles or affiliations at all. They're just doing it the independent route, and they're making some fantastic tracks. So I do this podcast called The Sound of Freedom, and it's conscious hip hop, it's conscious reggae. I put some other styles in there as well. I go back to previous decades and play some old rock records and stuff from the 60s and 70s. It's all music that resonates, that speaks to you. It covers issues of conspiracy, truth, spirituality, stuff that's really going on in the world. And people might find it interesting to take that podcast in. It's completely free. I put it out on my SoundCloud and my MixCloud. And again, you can get the links to that from my main website, which is markdevlin.co.uk. And if anyone wants to drop me a line, you know, I reply to all emails. It's always good to get feedback, as long as it's not shills or haters or troublemakers, you know, who won't get a reply. But if it's constructive and if you're bringing something meaningful, then I always enjoy corresponding with people. So that's an invitation out there.
Awesome. Well, fun as always, man. And maybe you'll let me tag along on that little LA safari. That would be pretty awesome.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention it to you and see if, you know, if I pull it off, maybe you want to come along for the ride, because it should be quite an interesting trip.
Absolutely. I've gone up to LA for way worse reasons. So that would be pretty awesome. It's only a 2-hour drive. So
that would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, I guess I will see you then, or maybe we'll talk the next time your Musical Truth Part 2 comes out. But until then, take care of yourself, man.
All good, man. Thanks for having me back. You know, this is my favorite show, and we always have a blast when we talk. And I like the fact that you take me in lots of different directions, because you can get submerged in this stuff sometimes. So it's good to have a host that kind of keeps you on track, you know.
Appreciate it. You're too kind. All right, man. Have a good one.
All right.
Mark Devlin, people. Round of applause. My God. The man knows his material and presents it like a true champion. I don't know if he's done it, but I've seen him posting about the idea of doing these marathon presentations, like 8 hours long, David Icke style, and I'm just in awe and jealous, kind of. I wish I could retain information like that. I do some things well, but that is not one of them. Wow, though, I think we did do a great job not retreading the same content, but expanding on it and getting into other areas, and it is quite shocking how orchestrated all these musical trends and artists seem to be, actors too. I love this sort of material, though, because the MKUltra, psychedelics, multidimensional entities, topics are all related in my view, and you can easily segue between any of them. And I don't think the military intelligence links or the MKUltra program mean psychedelics have no value. I think even LSD, which is made in a lab, should really be considered a door opener. And these black ops groups wanted to see what would happen if they widely distributed door openers on a culture. And it got weird, I hear. I wish I was there to see it, but I'm told it got a little weird. But sometimes people write off psychedelics when they learn about this side of the coin, or the people that advocate for them, you know, which is basically what started the fight with Jan Irvin and I. He was convinced Terrence McKenna was an agent in this campaign. To my knowledge, his evidence of this is just an offhand comment Terrence made. I would call it a joke about him being some type of agent or plant. But Terrence made jokes all the time, so I don't find that strange. If there's more to it, I don't know about it. That is the extent that I've heard you can actually kind of implicate McKenna in all this. I'd be very saddened if this was confirmed, but I wouldn't deny the evidence if I felt it was strong enough. Someone repeatedly saying that it's been confirmed just doesn't really do it for me. I think Timothy Leary, of course, is a bit harder to defend. His connections showed quite a bit more, if you ask me. And even still, there are several guys who I love listening to recordings of that I consider very wise that are very connected or thought to be deceivers by a lot of people. Robert Anton Wilson, Manly P. Hall, even Alan Watts is a name that gets thrown around that people are skeptical of. So adding Terrence to that list wouldn't completely break my heart. In a certain regard, you'd expect the brightest minds of the past to sort of be in the upper crust of society in a way, or expect them to at least meet with other cultural and, from time to time, political leaders. They don't have to all be bad people. But those were pretty sticky times. I mean, hell, these are sticky times. I don't actually think I know of a time when things weren't sticky, really. So go where the evidence takes you, make your own conclusions, but be open to new information and try to always see where other people are coming from, even if you end up disagreeing. It makes all your arguments way less emotional. But how sick would it be to tour the Laurel Canyon area with Mark too? You know, that would be quite a blast. I also asked him the other day about Adele because I was curious. You know, all these breakout mainstream artists seem to fit the same mold, but Adele seems a bit like an outlier who is really just genuinely talented and pretty normal. But Mark pointed out that she, I guess, was a product of the Brit School in Croydon, just outside London, which has been a breeding ground for many of the British artists who have gone on to major commercial success, from, he mentioned, Lily Allen to Amy Winehouse, and also said that you could kind of consider it to be a UK Mickey Mouse club. So that is a bit suspect. I do really like Adele, though. I would be a bit shocked if she had a Miley Cyrus-style persona switch. That would be pretty jarring. But if I did have a little girl right now, that is kind of the person I would sort of steer her towards liking if I could influence that at all, really. People who are excellent at their craft and still humble. I love those kind of examples, those kinds of role models. They're really the best. But guys, if you only heard the first hour of this show and are curious to know what filled up the Plus show, we talked about the second summer of love where the UK rave culture exploded in the late 80s and early 90s. Mark laid out the conspiratorial threads revolving around Prince's death, which really blew my mind. Also, we got into blood sacrifices for fame, always a classic. But my favorite thing we talked about, what was most new to me, was some of these recent revelations about the Neverland Ranch and this concept of Peter Pan programming and the Peter Pan symbolism they use in it, as opposed to Wizard of Oz programming and Project Monarch stuff that we hear about with young girls. But between Prince and Michael Jackson, those segments are probably my favorite that I've heard in quite some time. But Mark's a master. He's a wordsmith. I expect nothing less. So sign up for Plus if you're interested. You get access to all the archives. There's more people signing up every day. The feedback from Plus members is really great. And you also get to influence the show a bit more. I mean, you're a shareholder, essentially. And you know who comes first in America, don't you? But hell of a show. Check out all of Mark's links in the show notes. Grab Musical Truth. It's the only book on these subjects you'll need. And I'm going to get out of here. Your move, musicians of military intelligence, culture creators, and Peter Pan programmers. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, the world isn't random. It's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned Russians. Take me.
Guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too.
I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon. But I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Hireside newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Hireside Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle. Sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Hireside newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?